is, you know, a whole other time factor. But he needs to do some things that are, you know, both morally and strategically important. Student loan debt, some of those issues. Use executive actions in ways not to, to speak to a base that is demoralized, but could be put back together. A lot of work ahead, but I think it's possible.
We're going to leave it there, but we thank you both so much for being with us. Katrina VandenHeuvel, editorial director and publisher of The Nation magazine, columnist for The Washington Post, will link to her pieces and to The Nation. And Ralph Nader, four-time presidential candidate, consumer advocate extraordinaire. That does it for our show. Democracy Now! Is currently accepting applications for human resources manager. Learn more and apply at democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman with Nermeen Sheikh. Be safe. Wear a mask.
You're tuned in to listener-supported community radio, KBOO Portland.
KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KBOO in accordance with requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KBOO Community Radio's open meeting policy is available at our website at kboo.fm. Due to the temporary closure of in-station activity at KBOO, meetings will be conducted online via public video conferencing unless otherwise noted. A public link and phone number to attend the meetings are available at our website. The Finance Committee meets on the third Thursday of the month at 4:30 p.m. Please visit our website at kboo.fm to verify if a meeting is being held.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, a warning. The pandemic's pushing Oregon hospitals to a crisis point, and it's expected to get worse in the next couple weeks. More Oregon teachers are leaving the profession. Why? They're walking away. And even though there's a drop in the state's high school graduation rate, there are positive signs coming out of the Oregon Department of Education. Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Thursday, January 20th, 2022. I'm Annette Newell. Glad to have you with us. 1,046. That's 62 more than yesterday. And that's how many people are in Oregon hospitals right now, suspected or confirmed with COVID-19. So this afternoon, Becky Holtberg spoke out. She's the president and CEO of the Oregon Association of Hospitals and Health Systems, and she's sounding an alarm about the weeks ahead.
So today we have 1,059 confirmed and suspected hospitalized COVID-19 patients. That's 74 more than yesterday. Our Delta hospitalization peak was just over 1,200, and we're on track to exceed that peak possibly by this weekend, maybe early next week. Hospitalizations have been growing steadily, and that growth is accelerating. You can see the increase from yesterday. Last week, we were seeing increases of 30 to 40 patients a day. So if you project this trend out, you can see the real challenges ahead of us. This Omicron surge is different than Delta. Delta hit Southern and Central Oregon harder than other regions of the state, but Omicron is impacting all regions of the state and pretty much all hospitals in the state. The lack of available hospital beds is pushing the system everywhere to a breaking point. There is good news. The good news is that most patients in the hospital with COVID-19 aren't as sick as they were during the Delta wave. But the sheer number of patients exacerbated by staffing and discharge challenges has the potential to overwhelm the healthcare system. And I'll talk a little more about those two specific challenges. The next couple of weeks are going to be really tough, and it is important for people to understand that. There is a war going on in our hospitals against this virus that isn't visible to the public. And for the next few weeks, we're going to have one focus, and that's on ensuring that Oregon patients receive the best care possible during this surge. Hospitals need support so they can continue to deliver that care. And I want to take a minute here to thank the governor, who has mobilized the National Guard and secured hospital clinical staffing. We're in a difficult spot, but without those resources, we would be in a far worse position. So I'm going to touch next on a couple of factors that are presenting particular challenges in this surge. The first is the staffing crisis. Hospitals are in a much worse position with staffing than at any prior point in the pandemic. You know, after 2 years on this COVID-19 roller coaster, many healthcare professionals just want off. Staff are physically and emotionally exhausted and dealing with challenging patients and conditions. Nationally, nearly 1 in 5 healthcare workers has quit during the pandemic, so this is not unique to Oregon. Hospitals are also facing significant numbers of staff out sick with COVID-19, just like other organizations. Schools have gone remote, businesses have shut down, but that is not an option for a hospital.
And again, that was Becky Holtberg, the president and CEO of the Oregon Association of Hospitals and Health Systems, speaking today. In the year 2020, nearly 1 in 5 Americans reported some level of medical debt. Healthcare costs continue to rise in Washington state. Lawmakers in Olympia are looking at proposals that could help contain the problem. Eric Tegedoff reports on how healthcare affordability is in the spotlight for the 2022 Washington session.
With costs growing, healthcare is set to be a major theme in Olympia this year. Sam Hatzenbieler is a health policy associate with the Economic Opportunity Institute. She says state lawmakers have made progress, but care still is becoming increasingly unaffordable. Hatzenbieler says some Washingtonians have to make tough decisions.
They're forced to choose between getting needed medical care and buying food, putting food on the table, paying rent, paying their car bill. And people shouldn't be forced to choose between these necessary pieces of being a human.
Across the U.S., the average worker's premium contribution has increased almost 300% over the past 2 decades, and Americans spend more than $1,500 each year on prescription drugs. To tackle drug prices, state lawmakers hope to establish the Prescription Drug Affordability Board. Lawmakers approved a similar board in 2020, but Governor Jay Inslee vetoed it because of its price tag. The Senate version of the bill had a public hearing this week. Another measure, Senate Bill 5688, would give the Attorney General oversight to ensure market consolidations don't result in increased cost. Hatzenbieler says the Attorney General also would ensure care isn't restricted.
For example, some Catholic mergers and acquisitions have resulted in reduced access to reproductive care, gender-affirming care, end-of-life care, things like that, and we want to make sure that consolidations don't result in this diminishing of care.
The bill includes a health equity assessment as well. It had a public hearing this week. Hatzenbieler says another important provision to her organization is in the budget and would increase funding for health care to immigrants. She says 105,000 immigrants in the state lack health care. Hatzenbieler notes that low-income people, people of color, and frontline workers in particular have shouldered a disproportionate impact from the pandemic.
We have an opportunity this session to correct some of those long-standing inequities and make sure that healthcare is not only more affordable and higher quality for those people who are disproportionately impacted, but for all of us.
For Washington News Service, I'm Eric Tegedoff. Find our 8 trust indicators to support transparency and accuracy at publicnewsservice.org.
A recent survey conducted by the Oregon Education Association reveals that amid nearly 2 years of COVID-related conditions, many educators are reaching their breaking points. Dr. Reed Scott-Slaybach, president of the Oregon Education Association, says simply educators in many places have run out of steam. Besides continually changing protocols and filling in where faculty is left, teachers are taking jobs out of state or simply leaving the profession due to ongoing challenges the pandemic has brought. Other problems include years of underfunding for basic resources and that roughly 25% of Oregon teachers have recently become eligible for retirement. Despite a small drop in the 2021 high school graduation rate, there is encouraging news overall coming out of the Oregon Department of Education. With more on the story, here's KBOO's Josh Salem.
Nearly 81% of the Oregon high school class of 2021 graduated on time in 4 years. It's the second highest rate since 2014, but it is a 2-point drop from 2020, the highest year recorded. The Department of Education has worked hard to minimize the effects of COVID-19 on students. The class of 2020 was approaching the end of its senior year when schools first shut down that March. In contrast, the class of 2021 had their entire senior year during COVID. Schooling took a variety of forms, including distance learning, hybrid, and full face-to-face in-person classes. Sometimes this changed during the school year. Department of Education Director Colt Gill said, quote, "For most students in Oregon, they got instruction delivered in an entirely new way that was entirely new to the educators and entirely new to the students for their entire senior year," end quote. Gill added the students overcame tremendous challenges in accessing their education. Portland Public Schools' graduation rate rose slightly, while Salem-Keizer and Beaverton rates declined. Salem-Keizer Assistant Superintendent Ethan Udo-Senata said the statewide average is a representation of the resiliency and dedication of students, staff, and families. The Department of Education also released the 2020-2021 dropout rates, but it is difficult to meaningfully compare them to previous years. Last year, Oregon suspended a rule removing students from attendance rolls if they missed 10 days. The dropout rate last year was 1.81% versus 3.26% in 2019, the last full year before the pandemic. The graduation rate for students experiencing houselessness dropped to just over 55%, 5 points below the 2019 to 2020 rate. For KBOO News, I'm Josh Salem.
Thousands of educational resources, including open source textbooks, can now be downloaded free of charge. At one school, the University of Nevada at Las Vegas, it's saving students money. Suzanne Potter has more.
Open source textbooks that are free for anyone to use are a rising trend at colleges and universities looking for a way to make higher education more affordable. And now the University of Nevada, Las Vegas is on board. Students in the freshman seminar at the College of Liberal Arts can save $80 each by downloading their required textbook for free. Professor Denise Tillery says the cost of textbooks can be a significant barrier for many low-income students.
A lot of times students will have to wait to buy the textbook until their financial aid has been dispersed, or even then they can't afford it, or they're scrambling around getting used copies that might be a different edition than the one that's being used in the classroom.
I'm Suzanne Potter. Collectively, the 375 students taking that class will save about $30,000. The average full-time undergraduate at UNLV spends more than $1,200 per semester on books. The book is one of many offered free on the internet at a site called OpenStax, run by Rice University. The University of Minnesota offers a similar service called Open Textbook Library. Tillery says other departments are taking initiative as well.
There are some faculty at UNLV in the computer science department that are actually writing their own textbook, and they're going to make that freely accessible for any other class that might want to use it.
Students also should be aware of the American Opportunity Tax Credit for educational expenses, worth $2,500 a year. If the credit brings the tax you owe to zero, you can get up to $1,000 in refunds. Support for this reporting was provided by Lumina Foundation. For Nevada News Service, I'm Suzanne Potter. Find our 8 trust indicators to support transparency and accuracy at publicnewsservice.org.
A $240 million prison project in Nebraska is drawing some criticism. Eric Alotis reports the governor says it's an answer to overcrowding and recidivism. But others say it would be better to invest the money in mental and behavioral health care, as well as job training programs.
Critics of Governor Pete Ricketts' call for the Nebraska legislature to fund a new prison argue the money would be better invested in programs that have proven track records for reducing crime and preventing people from entering the criminal justice system. Retired University of Nebraska-Lincoln professor Fran Kay has volunteered in Nebraska's prisons for 25 years. She says mental health programs, addiction treatment, and job training programs can reduce crime and make communities safer.
Prisons are really kind of an awful idea when you come to think about it. I mean, you don't want to be in a position where you're punishing people after they've done something wrong. You don't want them to do wrong in the first place.
Supporters say the proposed 1,500-bed prison, listed as a $240 million line item in an appropriations bill, will create jobs and is necessary to address the state's overcrowded corrections population. Kay cites research showing that Nebraska can end overcrowding by limiting the use of stacked sentencing and getting more people back into communities through diversion programs and parole. She adds that Nebraska is not a wealthy state and only developers will benefit if lawmakers approve a project with a $250 million price tag.
You get as much money for building a preschool as you do for building a prison. Why don't we build more treatment centers? You get as much money for building a treatment center as you do for a prison. Why don't we build more job training? training centers.
Pointing to the state's high recidivism rate, Kay says Nebraska has done a poor job helping people who have served time heal and re-enter society as contributing community members. She believes building another facility will not make those communities safer, in part because prisons create an environment known to lead to violent behavior.
Fear, shame, isolation, exposure to violence, powerlessness. What do prisons create? Why in the world would we spend all that money on an institution that is best at creating violence and is lousy at healing?
This is Eric Galatis reporting for the Nebraska News Connection. Find our 8 trust indicators to support transparency and accuracy at publicnewsservice.org.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned after this newscast for an in-depth report. Sol Mora from the Coalition of Communities of Color talks to us about a community survey they're running so people can have input in the charter review process. At 6 o'clock, it's Rose City Native Radio. Then at 7, Hard Knock Radio. At 8, listen to Ear to the Streets of Portland. Tonight's weather, cloudy skies down to a low of 41. Tomorrow's weather, mostly cloudy, up to 48. Looks like a decent weekend on the way, partly sunny Saturday and Sunday, highs around 50. Today in history, on this date in 1945, Franklin Delano Roosevelt was inaugurated to his fourth and final term as President of the United States. Our quote of the day is from Roosevelt, who said, "Democracy cannot succeed unless those who express their choice are prepared to choose wisely. The real safeguard of democracy, therefore, is education." Voting rights efforts fail in the United States Senate. The January 6th committee subpoenas Rudy Giuliani. National Guard leaders testify in prosecuting sexual misconduct. And the government's at-home COVID-19 test website is up and running. With more on the stories impacting our democracy, here's today's edition of 2022 Talks.
Welcome to 2022 Talks, where we're following our democracy in historic times.
The question today that's before us today is as old as the Republic itself. The story of democracy has been a long march toward universal suffrage.
The Senate failed to pass voting rights legislation yesterday after weeks of back and forth and hours of debate. Democrats, with Senate Majority Leader Chuck Schumer leading the charge, failed to gather the 60-vote filibuster-proof majority necessary to get the bill through the chamber. An effort to bypass the filibuster also failed as Democratic Senators Joe Manchin of West Virginia and Kyrsten Sinema of Arizona held to their promises to oppose the rule change. Since the November 2020 election, state legislatures across the country have enacted dozens of restrictive voting measures, which the voting rights package could have curtailed. But Senator Tim Scott, a Republican from South Carolina, argued Democrats' claims of voter suppression are overblown.
If we're going to have an honest conversation about the right to vote, let's engage in that based on the facts of the laws that are being passed, not the rhetoric surrounding those laws.
The measure's failure is a major blow to the Biden administration and Democrats during a midterm election year. Prior to the Senate's vote, President Joe Biden, who marked his one-year anniversary in office today, accused Republicans of obstructing his legislative priorities.
I don't think there's anything unrealistic about what we're asking for. I'm not asking for castles in the sky. I'm asking for practical things the American people have been asking for a long time.
A House committee charged with investigating the January 6th insurrection has subpoenaed members of former President Donald Trump's legal team, including Trump's personal attorney, Rudy Giuliani. In a statement, the panel's leader accused the attorneys of advancing unsupported theories of election fraud and seeking to overturn election results. Meanwhile, the Supreme Court on Wednesday rebuffed Trump's bid to shield certain records from the committee. Politico reports the decision will open up a trove of documents that could help shed light on Trump's actions leading up to the insurrection. A separate House subcommittee held a hearing Wednesday on efforts to prosecute sexual misconduct within the National Guard. According to the Department of Defense, reported sexual assaults in the Guard spiked from 173 in 2009 to 607 in 2019. The hearing was led by Representative Jackie Speier, a Democrat from California and chair of the House's Armed Services Subcommittee on Military Personnel.
To the National Guard, the spotlight of Congress is on you. Take care of your soldiers, take care of your airmen, stamp out sexual harassment and assault, Stop the retaliation.
And a government-run website to order at-home COVID-19 tests is up and running. People could order up to 4 tests through covidtests.gov. The site logged about 50 million visits during its first 36 hours online. I'm Jonah Chester for Pacifica Network and Public News Service. Find our 8 trust indicators to support transparency and accuracy at publicnewsservice.org.
Most states have Good Samaritan laws, which protect people experiencing an overdose from arrest and criminal prosecution. They also protect people who seek medical attention for them. Lily Bolke reports on how advocates are urging for an expansion of one state's Good Samaritan law.
The bill before the Maine legislature would expand the state's Good Samaritan law that protects people seeking help for an overdose from arrest or prosecution. Currently, the law protects the person who is experiencing the overdose and the person seeking medical assistance for them. But Courtney Allen with the Maine Recovery Advocacy Project says it does not protect everybody at the scene, and it does not protect people for things such as bail or probation violations. She says the expanded bill would fill those gaps.
This law is too weak to protect most of my community members, and drug-using communities are very well aware of it. We must pass a Good Samaritan law that is clear and concise and able to be executed out to drug-using communities that they understand and that they trust.
Bill sponsors note that being arrested or convicted for drug-related offenses can have major impacts on people's ability to get housing, employment, or student loans. Counselor and Narcan trainer Sherry Talbot says it's important to call 911 when an overdose occurs, even if Narcan, a treatment for opioid overdoses, has been administered. She says opioids can last longer than Narcan, and there may be other substances involved.
The number of cases where people aren't calling 911 is absolutely overwhelming in the area I work. We hear about very few overdoses, except for the ones where people don't make it. It is so vital. I cannot stress enough. It is vital that people feel safe to call, because right now they don't.
47 states plus Washington, D.C. have a Good Samaritan law, and nationwide, the Government Accountability Office has found that those states see lower opioid-related overdose deaths. And when people know about the law, they are more likely to call 911. This is Lily Bolke with Maine News Service. Find our 8 trust indicators for transparency and accuracy at publicnewsservice.org.
Supporters of wind and solar projects say because of environmental benefits, human health won't be as negatively impacted in the long run, so they're trying to dispel some misinformation on wind and solar amid utility rate hikes. Mike Moen reports.
Minnesota is seeing a flurry of utility rate hikes either being considered or taking effect. Those who support renewable energy warn there's some misleading information in the public sphere about what's behind the activity. Xcel Energy has a pending rate hike before state regulators. If approved, it would boost electricity rates by 21% over 3 years. Minnesota Power also proposes a substantial increase. Some policy groups opposed to renewable energy are out with campaigns suggesting these plans are solely caused by wind and solar projects. But Isabel Ricker of Fresh Energy says that doesn't tell the whole story, noting there's aging infrastructure to be updated.
The fundamentals of our electricity system, the poles, the wires, some of the larger equipment at substations.
Xcel Energy does say upgrades would help the utility better transition to clean energy. And Fresh Energy says a more modern system would make it easier for Minnesota to rely on these sources, also arguing they're still a less expensive investment than traditional power plants. Both utilities won approval for smaller interim hikes late last year. Annie Levinson-Falk is with the Citizens Utility Board. While her group is fighting some rate hikes, she says utilities do see the need for investments in energy sources that are more economically viable in the long run.
The sooner that utilities can move off of that old power generation, the more money they're actually going to save for their customers.
Investment banking firm Lazard says wind and solar costs have declined by at least 70% over the past decade. As for rate hikes, Cub notes other factors, such as demand changes during COVID, impacting utility revenue. And Fresh Energy says there are still false claims being floated about the reliability of wind and solar. Ricker says in the Midwest, these sources are managed in ways that allow them to function at a high level in the winter.
Wind turbines here are outfitted with winterizing equipment to ensure that they don't freeze and they can operate at cold temperatures.
Ricker acknowledges other options, such as geothermal generators, will likely be needed in aiding a robust renewable energy system. Meanwhile, both groups say regulators traditionally try to keep rate hikes on the lower end so that customers aren't paying for anything deemed unnecessary. Mike Moen, Minnesota News Connection,
Find our rate trust indicators to support transparency and accuracy at publicnewsservice.org.
A woman named Amelia was living outside in Washington State before she moved into a hotel that was turned into a homeless shelter. That's just one example of an indigenous perspective on people experiencing homelessness. Eric Tegadoff talks to Frank Hopper with Yes Media about how a Native point of view could shift the narrative on homelessness.
An indigenous perspective could provide a way to think more sympathetically about people experiencing homelessness, a Native journalist says. Frank Hopper had an epiphany about a woman named Amelia who lives outside in his Tacoma neighborhood. He says people were complaining about her on social media, which bothered him, so he decided to bring her some smoked salmon strips. After envisioning ways to help her, Hopper realized it wasn't up to him to rescue her, and that the most beneficial thing he could do was be her friend.
Once I understood it like that, it was like all of the knots that were holding things up were untied, and good things just started to happen naturally. Once I started to treat her as a human being as opposed to an object that my community was complaining about and being concerned about.
Hopper says the day he came to tell Amelia about some potential housing options, she was gone. She moved to a hotel that the city of Tacoma, Lakewood, and Pierce County helped the Low Income Housing Institute purchase and turn into a homeless shelter. He says there likely are about 2,000 people who are homeless in Tacoma. The city of Tacoma sits on what was once Puyallup tribal land. Hopper says Puyallup tribal members have a different relationship to the land, seeing it as something akin to a relative, and that there was no such thing as homelessness before non-Native residents came. He says the Western perspective of land sees it as a commodity, which isolates people onto their own patch of land.
Going back to a Native perspective on the land, it seems very natural to try and assist someone who's obviously struggling out in the open, living outside, especially a young woman like Amelia, who's very vulnerable.
Among the solutions to homelessness in the region are tiny homes. The Puyallup tribe used pandemic funds to establish a village with 30 tiny homes on tribal trust land. Hopper hoped to help Amelia, who is not Native, settle in one of Tacoma's other two tiny home villages before she disappeared. He says it's important to remember that rapidly rising housing prices are the reason for increasing homelessness.
It's not a moral issue. It's not a failing on people's parts. The main cause of homelessness is economic, and that's what needs to be addressed. We shouldn't try to heal people specifically. We should try and heal the system.
For Washington News Service, I'm Eric Tegadoff. Find our 8 trust indicators to support transparency and accuracy at publicnewsservice.org.
You are listening to the KABU Evening News for Thursday, January 20th, 2022. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call or text us with your breaking news stories and tips at 971-245-2158. Our remote production team for tonight's newscast includes Jeffrey Wade, Josh Salem, Althea Billings, Eric Tegadoff, Mike Moen, Eric Galatis, Suzanne Potter, and Lily Bolke. The producer is Annette Newell, and our engineer is Otto. Special thanks to Public News Service. The director of Evening News is Althea Billings. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K2A2BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220 HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Annette Newell, glad to have you with us. All of our KABU programs, including the Evening News, are supported by our members. If you'd like to become a member and support your local community radio station, you can go to kabu.fm/give or text KABU to 44321. Stay tuned now for KABU News In Depth. We have an interview with Solomaro, the Coalition of Communities of Color.
KABU News In Depth, where we take a deeper look at the top news stories impacting our community.
Portland city government is weird, and I don't mean that in a glib way. We're the only major city with a commission style of government. Communities will have the opportunity to reassess that this year through the charter review process, where Portland's founding document may be updated or changed. The Coalition of Communities of Color is offering Portlanders the opportunity to weigh in on potential changes to the structure of Portland city government in an online survey. Changes to the type of government and how we vote have the potential to make Portland more democratic, more representative, and more equitable. I spoke with Sol Mora, the Civic Engagement Manager at the Coalition of Communities of Color, to learn more about the charter review process, what some of the options in the survey could mean in practice, and how Portlanders can chime in. We started by talking about how the community engagement work on this subject has been going.
So it has definitely been such a whirlwind. Before going into this position, I honestly didn't know what the charter review process was. And I think that that is where the majority of Portlanders and our community members fall into. You know, as I have been doing this work, I have just been realizing how inaccessible this type of information is to the Portland community at large. And so what it means for my role is really working with community partners and community-based organizations to ensure that we are educating our community bases about what these different city processes are, about ways that they can get involved and make sure that their perspective is heard in these types of processes. And so I have been working on designing different engagement activities, surveys, workshops, different ways that folks can get involved that may not be the traditional outlet of engagement. And our focus has really been to reach historically disenfranchised communities and communities of color. And so, you know, as we're thinking about city processes, those are the communities that tend to be left out of decision making in our city. And so at the Coalition, one thing that is very critical to the work that we do is centering everything through a racial justice lens. And so that means ensuring that communities of color do get to be at